Halo, halo.
Okay. Hello. This is on. Yes. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the November NIST lecture. So it's a pleasure to introduce to you Tommy Väisänen from Codenicon, who will talk about how they discovered Heartbleed. The floor is yours, Tommy.
Thank you.
Tommy.
Thank you. Can you hear me on the back? Yeah, I think it's on. Yeah. All right. So I gave a presentation yesterday about the discovery of Heartbleed, and for today I was asked to put something more, a little bit more technical stuff into it. So I decided that I will start off with just maybe highlighting and talking a little bit more about the actual technology and the methodology behind Heartbleed discovery. And then at the end point of my presentation, I will actually do the same part as I did yesterday. So to start off with, this is the big question, and this is where we start off with a little bit more technical stuff, and then go more abstract level when we discuss about the Heartbleed. So challenging product quality is one of the big topics in our daily life, pretty much. So you can imagine that if you go out and you're in the process of buying a car, I don't know anyone who would buy a car without test driving that car first. I mean, you wanna get the feel for it, how it feels, how the pedals work, how the clutches work, how the exchange and the gears work. You wanna hear and hear all the sounds that are in the car before you actually make a buying decision for that. Well, that is pretty much the same kind of thing that we do with fuzzing, and we do it for software. We put that software into its real scenario, put it into use for real, but instead of looking whether it performs properly, we try to make it perform improperly. And the method for that is fuzzing. So how that relates to security, this must be familiar to most of you. Security is compromised either with confidentiality, integrity, or availability parts. Fuzzing addresses all of these items here. When we look at Heartbleed, we realize that there is confidentiality and integrity that were jeopardized because of this particular bug, and as it was discovered through fuzzing. Availability is something that we have worked and seen quite often and pretty much everywhere, and we also learned today that there was an outage and availability problem in the networks yesterday, on mobile networks in Norway. So these all three items, confidentiality, integrity, and availability, are in the scope of fuzz testing. When we start to look at security testing, very often we get into discussions where we ask, and I ask, that okay, do you look for vulnerabilities in your software? It is the top part of that iceberg that is usually in the discussions. They are looking for the known vulnerabilities. So every time you look at known vulnerability, it means that someone has made effort into discovering a vulnerability in piece of software, reports it to somewhere, to CERT, to another place, and then that vulnerability gets a CVE code and it becomes updated to databases where vulnerability scanners are able to catch it. Fuzzing is focusing on what lies beneath. We don't really care that much what others have found before. We actually look at the device, the software, and we try to attack it from the protocol interfaces, and we really don't care what code, whether it's C code, Java, whatnot, what the programming code in the software has been. We only care about the protocol interface, how it communicates with the external world. And this is where we actually get to the bottom of these unknown vulnerabilities, the zero days, the most severe kind of faults in the software. So what is fuzzing? Very much, this is a heading that we have had in our presentations, in our speeches for years. Codenomicon is 15 years old now, and this is still the fact that so fuzzing is identified as a very effective way to discover and find vulnerabilities from the softwares. There's a number of cases where we can see this happening, and if you go and Google Codenomicon or look at search kind of these advisories, you will see a number of different vulnerabilities that have been discovered by our customers using the technology that we have. So fuzzing is a testing technique where you intentionally send malicious input to a device. That is to say it bluntly or easily. So when you have a protocol specification somewhere, you have a client and a server that communicate, and the communication happens through a protocol interface. This protocol interface is defined to contain certain type of inputs, file types, contents, information elements, and so forth. Fuzzing that protocol interface is when we introduce something that is not specified, something out of the scope. If the information element in the specification says that this value should be between 1 and 10, fuzzing is when you introduce letters into that information element field, or you introduce a value 11 or something beyond that, or minus 2 or something like that. So if you look at the user manual of like a remote controller like this, and it says that when you push this button, that the beamer should go on. Fuzzing in this scenario would mean that you push two buttons at the same time, or all of the buttons at the same time. You try to break and make it behave in a way that it's not supposed to behave. The problem with this method or the challenge really is that the input space is infinite. You can always come up with new ways and new inputs to put in. So it's really, really difficult to actually say when you have fast enough or you have reached the end of the part. There is no such thing. The challenge is really to make the most use of the limited time that you really have and find a really good fuzzer that is really skillful at testing the right values in the right type of places using the right type of protocols and so forth. So how to do that? There's different fuzzers out there. One fuzzing technique is random fuzzing. This is where you actually just randomly pump in something to your protocol interface. So it's like having a monkey writing Shakespeare, just pushing buttons. No, it doesn't really make sense. He doesn't know what language he's speaking, and so forth. It's really one way to fuzz. It does certain things. It can discover certain type of things, but it's not really time-wise effective. It's not bug-wise effective. So then there's more slightly advanced techniques available. One is mutation fuzzing. This is where you take a sample of some traffic between different entities and different communications. You insert or give that sample, traffic sample, to a fuzzer, and then it uses that sample to create the test cases. The quality of this method is exactly as good as the samples you give it. So it's the same way that it is as good as the sample, but it's also as bad as the sample. And it doesn't test all the other features, functions within that protocol communication. Now, what is academically and research-wise proven also is the most effective one is this generational fuzzing, where you actually build up a model of this protocol communication so that the fuzzer understands the language that it's supposed to speak. And it also understands what kind of anomalies it can insert so that it would be the make most sense, so to say. So it's really fast to execute because it understands it. It can target it, those anomalies, to the right places. And it also makes the mitigation process much easier when you actually know where to look for the faults in the code when you find one. And just comparison-wise, I will come back to that a little bit later, but pretty much what can be tested, that's a big question. But anything, any device that has a input and output interface somehow. That beamer over there, this PC over here, all of your handsets can be tested, any software that you can pretty much imagine. There's really no limit to this. Now, as the internet expanding, the devices being connected to internet is growing exponentially, there's awfully a lot of new things that you can be tested, but also new things that can start sending weird inputs to the network. We had just not too long ago, there was a refrigerator that was part of a spamming botnet. So sooner or later, you might have a refrigerator in your home that is part of a denial of service attack or something like that. So this is just making the attack surface much more wider than it's ever been before. The things that we are testing and I have capabilities to test, there's over 200 protocols, close to 300 now. But it's anything from wireless Wi-Fi connections, connected devices, Bluetooth devices, the medical devices, TVs, automotive infotainment systems, anything that has a connectivity interface. There's guys at the moment in Berlin participating in Bluetooth plug fests, and they have been testing all kinds of different Bluetooth-enabled devices, which all are have vulnerabilities in them based on the tests. So, going more deeply into the actual fuzzers and what makes a good fuzzer and what the questions to be asked there are, if you start to measure them, there's one side of things. If you have a product and it has been not fuzz tested ever before, 100% failure rate when we start to introduce fuzzing into that. So if you are working for an organization that produces a device, piece of software that would be critical somehow, make sure that there's fuzzing at some point in the development cycle. Doing some fuzzing is better than no fuzzing at all. This is just a fact of a matter. Simple test coverage is interface coverage. So if you take just an example, like a voice over IP gateway that uses SIP technology. That SIP is just one protocol in it, but there's all kinds of things underneath, going all the way to Ethernet level. So it's not really just you might focus on one specific protocol interface, but you need to look at the whole product, what it's made of, what kind of communication interfaces it has. If you go only on one level, you miss out on what lies beneath. If you focus on only the lower levels, you might lose out what's above. It all hangs in together. And it has to be kept in mind that this is not a one-off thing. As soon as you do a test run on a device and you are happy with the results, you start developing something more into it, the results from yesterday don't matter anymore. As soon as you change something in the code, you need to do the same tests again. So it's a continuous process that needs to be ongoing all the time in order to build security in to the software. Then interface coverage, a little bit described that as well. This is an example of internet-enabled TVs that we tested. In those TVs, it's not just the IPv interface that you can look at there. There's a Linux machine underneath quite many of those TVs. But there's all kinds of protocol interfaces you can test, even videos, audio, and images. And if you look at the results from this test, there's one line that is really staggering, which has 100% failure rate, which is the DVB protocol interface. Now, this is, again, a sign that we read so that it says that it has never been fast before. 100% failure rate. IPv4, even though it's what, 30 years, 25 years old protocol, you would imagine that, assume that it's robust and secure, we still see either outdated versions of it or edited versions of it, and it still fails in some occasions. Then the smartness. Now, this is where we come to compare the different fuzzing techniques. A Dumbass fuzzer is doing random mutations to a template. So you give it a sample file, a PCAP file, a file format or something like that, and it starts to create randomly test material based on that. A smart fuzzer uses that protocol model as the basis. It understands the language that the target system is speaking. So it uses really like powerful algorithms to generate the test cases. And this is the comparison results. If you look at the blue line over there, over here, this would be, if I remember correctly, this would be time on the x-axis and y would be the number of bugs found. Now, if you compare a smart fuzzer and then a dumb fuzzer, they don't meet anywhere. This is a huge difference, specifically if you're working for an organization that is developing products. You can invest an awfully lot of time in fuzzing and this kind of testing and get some out of it. But if you invest in right type of smart fuzzers, you will achieve much more in much shorter time. And then also another thing, which is not possible with the sample-based, they don't understand the language that the target device is speaking. So when you introduce a smart fuzzer which understands the language, you get to go on different levels of the protocol communication into introducing these anomalies. And this means also that you get much more in-depth into that actual protocol communication rather than just playing around with the higher level. And this is where the like threat analysis scenario comes into play in organizations and development processes. What is the likelihood of a certain event occurring within the system is when you start to imagine these kind of things. If you introduce an anomaly on the field level and your system crashes straight away, that's pretty bad, because you can almost anyone could do that. If you introduce an anomaly on a sequence level, or you break the protocol structure completely, that requires much more understanding, much more effort actually introducing that kind of faults into the system when you want to get in somewhere. So there's really very much differences in how you do it and what to do. Then what are the failure rates or failure modes of devices? We've seen all kinds of things. We've seen one message killing down a complete phone systems, not load, just one simple protocol message that is malformed. We've seen denial of service scenarios. We've seen cases where the server's CPU processing goes to 95% with just one message, not crashing it, but just causing delays. So it's really difficult to guesstimate or estimate what is the failure mode in the end, but it really can be anything from a crash to a very subtle fault. So here's just an example of a dumb mutation fuzzer that was run for a very long period of time. The x-axis is days, so the whole picture is like 30 days long, and the y-axis is the amount of bugs discovered. So if you run a dumb fuzzer in 2 days, it pretty much, or in 2 weeks, it pretty much found the bugs that it really can find. After 30 days, or after 25 days, it didn't find anything more. But this is still not to say that day 31 it would find something new. But it's just as an example that you at a certain point in time, you will reach a level where the fuzzers don't actually find out anything new, which is pretty good level when you think about investing time in testing. So here's another example of comparison between the different type of one very interesting fact can be seen from this. Here's a scenario where the founders of Codenomicon asked their friend to code a very simple HTTP server and plant bugs there on purpose. And then they put up different types of fuzzers to try and test that server implementation and see how fast, how effective they were. And here's a comparison. Generation fuzzers or the dumb fuzzers, mutation fuzzer ran for 118 hours, so about 5 days. And after that, it didn't find any more bugs. Generation fuzzer, the smart one, ran for 17 hours and reached the same level. So there's 100 hours of difference in effectivity to finding different things. Interesting part on the left-hand side here is that if you look at the actual bugs that they discovered, mutation-based fuzzers found only 4 unique bugs. Generation-based fuzzers found 10 unique bugs, but only 2 of them were the same. So when we realized and started to investigate the results of this study, we understood that if you're comparing like what kind of where to invest, generation fuzzers would be the best ones to go off and start with by any means thought of. As the criticality of the system increases, then you need to introduce also other techniques in order to have some additional results. Like here, they only found 2 same bugs. There was 2 bugs that mutation-based fuzzers found that the generational based didn't find. Something to think about. Then efficiency comparison. This proxy template evolutionary and generational. This is pretty much the same kind of thinking there. Generational is where the fuzzer is the most effective one, finding the most amount of bugs in the least amount of time, as opposed to the ones above. So who is doing fuzzing? Pick and choose any secure development lifecycle description you can Google and find a picture. At some point there is a term that says fuzzing is included. So it's integral part of any secure development lifecycle process if you want to really build a secure software. But there can be one definition of where it fits in. It can be agile, where it's not run overnight, over weekend. Every time there's software that works, you can run fuzz tests against that. So very briefly, a little bit more technical stuff on the fuzzing parts. Any questions on this? All right. Then about the Heartbleed. All right. So this is how many of you were yesterday? Ah, so many. All right. So this is a repeat of what I said yesterday or spoke yesterday. So this is more like a high level presentation. It's not a technical one, and it's based on interviews with the people actually working in the discovery part of Heartbleed. And this is, the information is purely from our perspective, so it doesn't take into account what happened around the world that much. Only what we saw happening before, during and after. So keep that in mind. So road to discovery of Heartbleed, the start point was when the guys in Oulu University Secure Program Group started off doing research on why do software fail? Why do software crash? It was a research program or university like here in Jövik. They created a prototype of Defensix, which is the product name. They called it Protos. They built that Protos with the idea of testing something that is really common, the protocol interfaces of different softwares. It was a fuzzer that I just described. And they took this ASN1 SNMP protocol as the first target because it was really widely used everywhere in all kinds of communication devices you could imagine around the world. And as soon as they started running tests against that, they realized that this is something totally huge. There were so many different, hundreds of different kinds of categorized faults in this protocol specification itself, which meant that if you had a communication device or any product that had this particular protocol implemented, it was vulnerable, 100% vulnerable. So it was so severe that they, when they wrote the report to CERT in Finland, it was reported all the way up to the White House. Gentleman over here, Howard Schmidt, used to be the chief of cybersecurity for Bush administration and later also for Obama administration. The papers here in his hands are the papers of the inventors or the founders of Codenomicon from the University of Oulu about this particular vulnerability. So this was really severe, and it was kept very low profile for nearly 2 years so that all the manufacturers could patch their softwares, release new software that is not vulnerable anymore. So it was like that point when the founders realized that this technology would have a commercial value to world and to make the internet safer place. Heartbleed was something that rose up this year, but it's certainly not the first one. It certainly will not be the last one that has a high impact. You can read the advisories or vulnerabilities that have been discovered and disclosed with our technology during the years, so there's quite a significant number of different types. And like I said earlier, if you go and type in search words, Codenomicon or Defensix to search databases, you will see a number of different vulnerabilities that has been discovered with this. So the technology is really powerful, and the technique is really powerful. Codenomicon today, we have three main business areas. AppCheck is one new business area where we a customer can upload his software to that service. The application will be scanned throughout, and it will identify what kind of open source components exist in that piece of software. And it will also identify the known vulnerabilities related to that, those libraries or third-party components. And it will also tell about the licensing problems or liabilities related to those components. Defensix is the one that has started off the whole company. It's the Fuzzer platform for a number of different protocols. Abuse Situation Awareness, or Abuse SA, is a technology platform that is used by CERTs around the world to monitor the health and internet abuse in the countries. Finnish authorities are using this to monitor infections or internet abuse in the country, and 20 other CERTs around the world as well. So, road to discovery. Now, this is I think this is a fairly good example of collaborative problem solving, because it starts off with a few years back when there was these guys who were developing Defensix and this Ike suite. They were thinking about one specific problem which was related to this protocol. So the users were able to access Ike servers with completely bogus user credentials. There was a problem and bug in that software. This wasn't really something that was so evident and clearly seen for the user. It was not easy to see that there was a problem in the software because it didn't crash. So the big problem here is that how do you actually catch software problems that are not so obvious? If the software doesn't crash, how do you actually know that it's malfunctioning? So these guys started to think about this. They started to think of different scenarios, how would they solve this case, put their heads together, and then created the safeguard concept to Defensix. So the concept of safeguard is where under fast testing runs, as Defensix is running, it also checks the responses from the target system. It identifies whether there's possibilities to bypass authentication. If you can get in access to some server with Donald Duck credentials, that's a bad thing. It also looks for cryptos that are being used, whether they are strong or weak, what versions are used, and also amplification problems. So if you could send a very small package to a system and it responds with a very large one, that's a bad thing as well, amplification problem. So this concept was created, and the guy started to work with it. Took about a year or two to actually start something, to having something that is functional and can be tested. So it led to actually the cause of Heartbleed. And for those of you who don't know what Heartbleed bug was, essentially, this is a very good grammar example of that. I really like this comic series. So here's a description of protocol communication between the client and the server. And this is defined in the specifications that it should go like this. When a client asks that, okay, are you there, server? If you are, reply to me with a certain response. In this case, if you're there, reply to me potato six letters, and the server should reply with potato six letters only. And then it tries another one. If you're there, respond to me hat three letters. And then the clever attacker starts to think about, I wonder what it does when I ask something else. So he sends, okay, if you are there, reply hat and 500 letters. So specifications would say that, okay, you can only use the same, ask the same amount of information as you are requesting. So he asks hat 500 letters, and what he gets is hat and 500 letters. So in reality, you could ask the server to send the memory blocks in 64 kilobyte instances. So for 2 years' time, it was actually more secure to use an unencrypted connection than it was to use an encrypted connection when this bug was around. Quite bad. And if this, since this was used by maybe 50% of internet servers around the world, it affected us all. Who has a Facebook account? Yeah. So, to put this into also into perspective, I'm not a techie myself. I don't understand this kind of communication at all. Letters are okay. Different languages are okay as well. But this kind of gibberish doesn't say much to me. But for the security experts, this is something really scary. This is the response to the Heartbeat protocol. And something is weird there. I don't know what, but that's something weird. And this is what the guys actually realized. So how it unfolded, this is where we get to the timeline discussions. April 2nd was when the Matti, one of the testers who actually started off the test runs, got a new build of Defensix with Safeguard. He installed it and set up that test automated test run against OpenSSL. And we use open source component as our test targets quite often. It's just a normal procedure for us. That when there's no real test target available, then we use open source components. It was set up for the night runs. And then during the night, when the test run had been going, Riku and Antti, who are the actual developers of Safeguard, they actually started to look at the results, and there was like hundreds of different alerts that were raised by the Safeguard feature. And again, this is pretty normal development process. You start off with a huge number of alerts, some of them real, some of them not. And then you start to iterate and improve the algorithm, how it works, and then scrape out the bad things and leave out only the real ones. And as they started to investigate these problems, alerts, they realized that there was this one particular message that was, out of hundreds, they picked up this one that was really interesting. It sends out something, asks for something in response, and it gets much larger response back than it was supposed to get. They started to think that, okay, this might be something really bad. And this is now Thursday morning. Previous one was Wednesday evening. Thursday noon, around lunchtime, brains hit together. Smart heads start to discuss about this. And they started to realize that, okay, this is something really severe. They created a custom anomaly, custom test case to actually verify that what they this was something real. And they were able to verify it immediately. Okay, now when we send this one in, we get this one out back, and it's totally against all specifications. Same day, still we are on Thursday. Thursday afternoon. CROSS, Codenomicon Robust Open Source Software, is a program where we test these open source components, and if we find something, we write a report to CERT so that it's been fixed somehow. The report was sent to the NCSC Finland, CERT Finland, for review, and the same evening they were able to verify with the new Defensix build that it was actually leaking also private key information, which raised its severity from a very high to extremely high in reality. So this is all what happened during Thursday. Then we go forward, Friday. Okay, we know that the server side is vulnerable. There's problems in there. We need to go forward. Start to look at the client side. And the results, everything is vulnerable. Same problem there, severity level again much higher. Then we go to the weekend. There's a lot of things happening. Questions and answers being gathered to get the facts right, prepare for press communication, media communication, prepare the marketing team to observe and monitor media coverage around the world so that each and every time there's some news or journalist that writes something that is not accurate, that is even misleading, we could act and correct the message so that the public and the general internet would be much faster fixed and this not could not be exploited. So a huge amount of work went into also through the open source communities to fix and help fixing the and patching the systems in silence before this would become public. Heartbleed.com was reserved during the weekend, but we didn't put it public until this would be disclosed by some party. So as soon as OpenSSL releases the information about this vulnerability, we open up Heartbleed.com so that the information would be spread around as fast as possible, and the people who actually need to act upon it, need to fix and patch their systems, could work based on real information, accurate information. Then we started off monitoring the media coverage, looking at what kind of things are being said, and making sure that each and every journalist that was addressing this issue would make address it the issue the right way, so that they would be not misleading by any means. So days after public disclosure by OpenSSL, this is the number of visitors, unique visitors to that Heartbleed.com. So April 7th, when it became public, there was not that much yet, but as soon as the news started to spread around the world, we could see close to 1 million hits per day. And here we had also distributed this load so that it was not in one site, so that it would be easily accessible to anyone who wanted to read more about it. Then the bad things, the bad parts. As soon as we had during the weekend, we had prepared for that this will become public at some point. We started to build up our own honeypots in order to measure and observe whether there's active exploit attempts for this vulnerability. And we were a little bit late with that, since we were ready to start monitoring that April 8th, and it became public April 7th, so we don't have any statistics on the Mondays, the 7th attacks or scans. But as soon as April 8th, there was this proof of concept created, the scanning started to increase. It took 3 days for better understanding of the vulnerability, that you could actually retract 64 kilobytes of memory from the server. And it took 7 days to actually integrate those proof of concepts into botnets. So this is a time when actually the mass harvesting of information started. If there was a server or service available out there that was not patched, your information went out. It was automated completely. So the Heartbleed scanning is still going on in the wild today, not in the same scale as it was in the early days, but still it is happening. We've integrated these features, safeguard features, to Defensix, so it's available for our customers at the moment. And then we are expanding that coverage also, that it's not just TLS, but it's DTLS and other protocols that also have those features. Then AppCheck is updated to alert on those vulnerable libraries if there are. So, couple key things here. This was yet another bug for us. Heartbleed is a big, severe bug, but for us it was yet another bug that we discovered during our normal development processes. We are not doing active vulnerability searching or research ourselves. We developed the technology that makes it possible for organizations to do it themselves. But these kind of things happen during the development processes. There was a huge number of open source communities involved in the patching process. A lot of people worked day in, day out, sleepless nights, no food during the first weeks pretty much, because of the activity level was so high. And today the technology that we create is being used quite often as a acceptance criteria to actually buy some products. Some companies and customers of ours tell their suppliers that, okay, if you want to sell to us, you need to have your products properly tested and use Defensix for that. So with that, I will thank you for my time, and if there's questions, I will be happy to answer.
Thank you, Tommy, and there's quite a bit more time for questions today than yesterday, so please, fire away.
Thank you for the nice presentation. I'm just curious about the situation, the floor in security of SS ILO. This Heartbleed was identified. Why it was identified so late? Because I'm not in this field, but to my humble understanding, the problem is something like a buffer overflow, which has already been there for many years. We can identify a lot of accidents there. Why this one was identified so late, or just because people think open source software, they always assume if it is open source, there must be a lot of effort already down there to test it, but actually not always this case.
I think you answered your own question pretty well. That is exactly how what I come across pretty much every year. I have given it also a name. I call it the security assumption, and it's really a bad headache that is running around in the industry. It's when it's a phenomenon where the people and the organizations who buy equipment, network attached equipment, they don't necessarily have the competence nor the people to actually tell the suppliers what kind of use they have for their products, what do they need to have, how are they supposed to be tested. So they naturally assume that, okay, the supplier knows what it's doing, they assume that, okay, they have tested it properly, but the buyer doesn't really take a stand that, okay, we want to see the results, or we want to know how you did it. And then the same happens with the supplier. He might use third-party components, open source components, when they are building their products. And they also assume that the previous version, previous supplier, the open source community has done proper testing. And they take those components and integrate it into products and sell them further. And then in the worst case, I've even seen this in reality when we've done a security audit for one product. It was not the integrator that had created the problem, not their supplier, but their supplier. And this is the security assumption that goes all the way through the development path, which is really problematic. Someone needs to take a stand to say that, okay, I want to have it tested this way, or I want to see how you have done it. That would be a starting point.
Thank you for your presentation. I have a question. What can I do as a customer, as a user? I mean, if you talk about access control to the computer, I can be instructed to have long passwords or whatever. But what can I do in this particular case?
With the Heartbleed case, nothing much. It's not us consumers or users, actually. It's not much we can do.
But in general, with software that I use?
With software that you use, one... that I have done myself, I can only speak for my own. As I started working with Codenomicon, I started to be really picky on what apps do I put in my phone, accept, what kind of softwares I use or tell my friends to use. It starts from there. How are they testing? What proof do they have on how they operate? Do they apply some sort of secure development lifecycle? I think it would be good for us all, consumers, citizens. It would be good if all the suppliers would start to apply some sort of secure development lifecycle in their development processes. That would be a starting point, because it means that they would integrate fuzzing as one critical item in their development process.
Do you know any big attacks as a result of Heartbleed? Because from what I gather, it was quite hard to actually get enough information using the attack methods to obtain passwords and such. Do you just reckon it was a big deal, even though it got patched so late?
I've seen some news that there was in China, there was 4.5 million patient ID data records were stolen using Heartbleed. And I won't be saying so that it was difficult to withdraw information. It was just one message, and you could do that over and over and over and over and over time. So that's my understanding of the case. So problem with Heartbleed was that it was simple to exploit. It was easy to repeat, and it doesn't leave any trace.
Thank you very much, Tommy. This is a question inspired by my colleague's question in terms of what can you do as a consumer. Should we not, as consumers, be demanding or at least requesting governments to have regulations in place that if people were dying in cars, we would require them to start doing testing? And that's what happened. A lot of people had to die beforehand.
Yeah.
Should we not be sort of pushing our the people in positions of authority to demand certain certification? In the credit card industry, we have PSI. Into that, should we not have something similar for the open source that before it's allowed to be allowed for any product? What do you think of common criteria then and the certification processes there? Where it's a long question, I know.
It is, and common criteria part would require an hour's discussion part. But if we take the first part of your question, demanding some sort of processes, definitely that would be a good thing. It needs to start somewhere. Very often, manufacturers of different devices go business first and security second, because security in itself doesn't necessarily mean that they can sell that as a feature to their customers. So some regulatory involvement is not a bad thing in that scenario. Whether that should be applied to open source, that's a difficult question. I would say that it might restrict the spreading of an innovation. If that would be limited somehow, I think it would rather be applied to the use that you are going to use that open source component for. If you are going to use your component, open source component, for a product or device that is being used in critical infrastructure, definitely then that should be properly tested.
Okay, on that, it's time to round off. I think Tom is around for a few more minutes afterwards for those who wants to have a little chat. Otherwise, I wish you a nice afternoon and a good weekend. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.